again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, talking to you today from a warming spring-summer morning in Vancouver. In a moment, you'll hear the voice of Rachel Pack, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Education, Research, and Innovation at Western University, on about two-thirds of the way across my country. We're talking today because she and her co-authors have a paper coming out in the July issue of Medical Education entitled "Some Assembly Required, Tracing the Interpretative Work of Clinical Competence Committees." Rachel, thanks for making the time.
Oh, thank you.
I asked if we could talk today because this paper seems particularly important and timely given the increasing use of clinical competence frameworks, I guess, first of all, and more specifically, the committees that you allude to in your title. But I suspect there's still lots of people around the world who have never heard the phrase clinical competency committee. So I think I need to begin by asking you to explain the context a little bit in terms of where your study was conducted.
Absolutely. So our study is conducted in the Canadian context. So clinical competency committees for us are small groups of faculty who are involved in teaching residents, usually the program director of whatever postgraduate program it is, a program administrator, who get together between 4 and 12 times a year, and they review all of the assessment data that's produced by CBME curriculum. So they'll be looking at things like EPAs, like test scores, clinical observations, narrative comments, any other types of assessments that are generated. And their job is really to make sense of all of this data that's generated about a particular trainee, identify opportunities for feedback, for coaching, and to make any progression decisions that are necessary, whether it's moving on to the next stage of training or being permitted to write the final licensing exam.
And so these are somewhat high stakes discussions, would you say? Are they more for formative purposes, or is this a group that purely makes it sort of go, no go decision in terms of the next stage of training?
Well, certainly there are many instances where there are high stakes decisions, but a lot are smaller, low stakes check-in decisions. They're reviewing residents 4 times a year or 5 times a year, 6 or 7. Some of those discussions are going to be smaller. Let's check in with this resident. Let's see how they're doing on all these different milestones. How are they doing on their exams? How are they doing in the clinic? Are there opportunities where we can support them? Maybe once or twice a year, they'll be moving stages or progressing in some other way. But often they're quite smaller, low-stakes conversations where there's no sort of big formal progression between stage of training, but there still might be components of that conversation that are higher stakes, whether or not the trainee needs some sort of coaching or needs to repeat an exam or some other component.
And so this is a group that's to some degree at arm's length from the trainee. They're getting fed a lot of data. Presumably some of the people on the committee are likely to know the trainees. But before we get into those specifics in terms of how this process took place and how these discussions evolved and used the data available, I want to highlight that one of the other reasons I was very interested in talking about this paper is you used a fairly unique methodology for a medical education research project. Not 100% novel, I don't mean, but in most situations like this, I would anticipate people would run some interviews and talk with people about their experiences on these committees. And your methodology was much more extensive. And so maybe I'll just ask you to speak to what you think to be some of the highlights.
Yeah, so we had two sort of methodological components to the study. The first piece was an observation. So myself and another team member attended committee meetings for all of the committees that participated in our study. And one of the reasons why we really wanted to do this is because decision making, when it involves a group, is fundamentally a social process. There's lots of discussion, there's debates, and we really wanted to see how people dug into the data. How did they make sense of it? How did they explain it? And what kinds of challenges might they come up against? So that was really important for us to be able to understand the process. Understandably, given that some of the decisions are very high stakes, there was a lot of negotiation we had to do with our clinical partners so that they would be comfortable with having us there and also feel comfortable that we weren't taking away any identifiable information about any of the trainees, any of the events they were describing, or the program itself. So we didn't record these meetings. We took some general field notes that really focused on the nature of the discussion rather than the content of the discussion. The other piece involved in the methods was doing an interview after each committee meeting with somebody there, somebody who was on the committee. And typically we tried to pick somebody who offered something really interesting at the meeting, whether they were sort of central in one of the debates or they were very intimately connected to making the committee run.
Great, thank you. And now I think we'll just jump into your findings if that's okay. I was intrigued in part by your notion that the committees held the assumption that they would be presented with high quality assessment data. Was that an assumption that they've grown into, or are groups like this actually told that they need to assume that the data are accurate?
I think that's quite a tricky question because I think part of what in the Canadian context has made programs excited about the idea of competency-based medical education is the idea that they were going to get more and better data. Right? So I think coming into CBME, people were hoping that the data was going to be really great. So there's sort of promise of great data. You have a new committee, you have new assessment forms that programs have been working on for a very long time to try and make really rigorous and useful. And then you also have people involved in the committee who are very committed to education. They really want to make sure that they're doing a good job for their trainees. And they also want to be fair. So we were fortunate enough to be at the first committee meeting for a couple of the committees that we observed. And almost all of them at the beginning of their first meeting would have a conversation about what it was that they were there to do. And usually that involved some sort of overt discussion of how they were going to make decisions based only on objective data, that they wanted to be fair, transparent, and in that there's an assumption that the data they're getting from EPA forms, from faculty, from test scores are going to be fairly objective. They're going to be reliable and that they'll help them make decisions that they can defend and that they can feel confident are fair. So it was quite an overt expectation and I think hope of many of these committees.
And anybody listening who's been on one of these committees will likely recognize it's an assumption that won't hold up universally. They've all undoubtedly encountered moments where they were challenged by the evidence that they were trying to grapple with, or even some contradictions that might be present in it. How did your committees or the individuals that you spoke with seem to work in efforts to resolve those sorts of challenges?
It was quite difficult. Almost immediately in the first meetings of many programs, they would come across situations where the data they were looking at didn't make sense for some reason, or it didn't enable them to make decisions easily. One of the very common things we saw was where programs were using new EPA assessment forms, and these forms have a numeric rating scale, so they go from 1 to 5, 5 being the highest, and 3 usually constitutes a sort of borderline non-successful score. And then below that, they would have space for narrative feedback. So they would look at these EPA forms, and a resident would get a 3, which is a non-successful grade. And then underneath it would be these really wonderful glowing comments about the resident's performance on the particular task. And they're struggling to make sense of, well, how do you reconcile these two things? This non-successful objective measure of performance and these really great comments about all the things the resident did right and how they were appropriate for the level of training. So it's quite difficult for them to make sense of things like that. And often what they would do is look at all the other assessments on that resident to see if they could garner some insight into which piece of that data is it the score that's perhaps not quite right, or is the faculty quite generous with their comments? And one of the most common responses we would see to problematic evidence is deciding to seek out more data. So if it was an EPA that required three successful, four or fives out of five, and the resident had two, and there was this murky three, they would wait and see if they could have another assessment that would be a clear four. Or they would ask for the trainee to complete more of that particular assessment.
Well, and actually makes me think if, while being objective and systematic and transparent, well, they're all laudable goals, and certainly makes sense that people would strive to achieve those things. I suppose if that were actually readily achievable, it would speak against the need for a committee anyway, because one could just create a simple algorithm and use the data as they existed. Did your participants, despite going in with those early stated goals, did they seem to struggle or feel comfortable with the processes as they were experiencing them?
I mean, from an outsider observer perspective, it seemed extraordinarily difficult for many committees. So if some problematic evidence came up in the discussion and the committee really had to wrestle to make sense of it, these discussions could take upwards of an hour, which is an incredibly long time to be looking at someone's assessment data, to be discussing various aspects of their performance, where if they had a case where everything really nicely and tightly aligned, where it was really quick and easy for them to say that this person did well, those discussions could take 5 minutes. And that trainee was done. But an hour is a very long amount of time to be wrestling with all these pieces. It seems quite unsustainable.
And so where do you think this sort of practice is heading? What would your data lead you to believe in terms of how these committees can be helped to do their work better, or how they might need to evolve in order to become more sustainable or effective?
Well, one of the things we really readily saw is that when committees would encounter types of problematic evidence that might be produced by user error, so assessor error, or a problem with the assessment system, whether it's the electronic system or the form itself, they would give feedback to try and change those things. So the example I gave you earlier, where the form you had a three, which is an unsuccessful ranking, and then great comments, a lot of the programs ran faculty workshops to say, this is how we need to use the form. If you're giving a three, we all need to have the same understanding of what a three is. And your comments need to provide some indication of why this trainee was unsuccessful. Or if they were having problems with their electronic system where forms were getting lost or not coming through for off-service residents, they were trying to figure out ways to fix that. Can we make sure we get this data? Things like that. So they were very heavily involved in different kinds of quality improvement measures that can resolve some types of problematic evidence when it comes down to problems with tools or practices, but you can't solve your way out of all of them. Some of them, I think, are fundamentally about how we think about what objective evidence is and what we think subjective evidence is.
That actually feels to me like a good note to end on. I realize there are a lot of details that could be discussed, but I think your note there about how this sort of committee serves a quality improvement purpose and that it should be an ongoing evolution is quite fitting, in that it in many ways models for the program, or at least the assessment system, what these systems are intending to nurture or facilitate on part of the trainee. So to remind our listeners about where those details are, the July 2019 issue of Medical Education contains a paper titled Some Assembly Required, Tracing the Interpretative Work of Clinical Competence Committees. And you have been listening to Rachel Pack, who's the lead author on that work, and presumably will be sharing more with us as her postdoc continues. Thanks very much, Rachel.
Thank you.